Anything. My Woburn story is really my family's story. This was a case for me that came up at a time in my life when my daughters, I have two daughters, Rebecca and Lila, they're just a year apart. In 1986, they were 10 and 9 years old. And I had been a very close, good father all the way up through their first 9 and 10 years. And then I got swept up into the Woburn case and suddenly was engaged in something that was completely absorbing, just more intense than anything I'd been in. And it remained intense for 3 years for me. 8 for Jan and longer for the plaintiffs, but 3 for me. I want to introduce my wife, Fern, who is the other part of this story. And the fact of it coming into my life and taking just a huge piece of it meant that it's a film that my daughters cried at when they saw it, because there were so many painful memories for them, I think. In some ways, they lost their father for a period, and it's been a very personal process of coming out of it and readjusting to it. The other way in which this is my story is that I went into this in 1986 very much believing in justice. I was a law student and then a lawyer and then a law clerk, and then a young lawyer working for the Civil Rights Division in the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Movement, and then a teacher, a few steps along the way, and then into this case, fully believing at the start that if you worked hard and you worked long and you fought the good fight, that you could make the justice system respond to you in a way that was right and good. And when we finished the appeal, the low point for me came not during the trial, not even immediately after the trial. The low point came for me at the end of the appellate process, when the First Circuit Court of Appeal saw what had happened and pretty much held their nose and took a breath and said, "Tough luck. You're out of here." And at that point, I got, I would say, maybe not as depressed as Jan got. When this case was over for him, he took off for Hawaii, and that's that scene at the end of the book where he's just swimming out. You don't know quite whether he's going to swim back. But this was an incredibly deflating experience for someone who really believed in the law, which I did. And it took me, I would say, another 3 years before I got back to a point where I started to feel good about the law again. For me, it was a process of coming to terms with the idea that there was something that we could have done to bring it out better, that it wasn't just something that happened to us and up against inevitable forces. So largely the story for me was one of, it has been one, of going back through and thinking about the places where we could have done it differently, where the case could have been won instead of, well, I won't say lost. I actually feel now that ultimately it is a win. It's a win because it's the story that's ultimately the victory. It's a question of whose narrative prevails in a competition for history. It's still going on. And W.R. Grace was in here 2 hours ago pushing the Grace story, and they're still going to get pushed. It's just, I hope now, possible to push them in ways that are friendlier and more interactive and more productive. So, all right, the story for me was one of going into something with incredible intensity and feeling that I came out of it with a bunch of liabilities, an awful lot of work to do, both in my family and in my work life. And so much of the story for me, I think, has taken place after it's been over. And I'd say that this very process that we're in today is part of it. I'd love to just open it up to questions. I'm delighted to respond to anything. I don't really have a speech beyond that for you, but I'd love to share anything. Yes, please. We have a microphone here, and if anybody's interested in anything I have to offer, hey, Fern, right here. You got to go for Fern. The number one lesson for me for a lawyer is that you have to learn to deal with disappointment. That there are two ways in which you handle disappointment. One way is to say, you were powerless. You just, it's like you don't want to go there again. It's like, it was a mistake for me to get in it. I was over my head in the first place. A lot of things that just put you down and make you feel depressed. And the other way is to look and see how you could have done it better so that you're ready to learn something from it and go out and do it better the next time. That is something that gets you up and going. So for me, I'd say the number one lesson is not so much a law lesson as it is a kind of human lesson about self-motivation and how you deal with adversity. I guess that'd be my number one. Great. I did not think the trial was too technically difficult for the jury. I think that there were some strategies afoot to try and make the trial kind of extended and boring and overly technical, but the actual issues are comprehensible issues that you can go deep with them, and you can certainly go deep beyond people's ordinary knowledge, but the issues themselves were pretty simple, and they're still pretty simple. Yeah. George Pinder. Yeah, well, I don't know. We had some pretty good comparisons in the trial that would kind of bear you out. George Pinder definitely fit your description. He definitely got in trouble in respect to it. On the other hand, we had some highly professional experts, like Olin Braids, who I would describe as a professional expert witness. And there are pitfalls in that direction as well. I mean, somehow to find the person who's at home in the environment and yet still a truly credible person they're hard to come by. In terms of my own academics and setting in and so forth, the biggest mistake, if I say to myself, what was the biggest mistake I made? I had an opportunity at the beginning of the case, very beginning, when I was first making my deal with Schlickman, to take a plaintiff. I feel I should have taken a plaintiff, because not having a plaintiff, I lost the right to speak in court. And I felt by the end of it that I would very much like to have been able to speak directly to the jury myself. Schlickman represented all the plaintiffs. It would have been possible for me to make a deal with Schlickman that says I only come in if I represent some of the plaintiffs. And if I had it to do over again, that's the one that I would have wanted. Now, I didn't do it because I'm an academic. I'm just not going to be there every day. It didn't all that kind of. I would have just said, nope, I'm going to do it anyway. Yeah. The answer is yes on all fronts. I think, and I've done the same thing in a different way. I'm not an environmental litigator, but I am a litigator. I have a client right in back of you here, sitting in the back row, Peter Berkowitz. Peter Berkowitz is an assistant. He's an assistant professor who was denied tenure at Harvard, and we're litigating it. But the way we're litigating it is explicitly not to take it to court. We're litigating it through the internet, and we're litigating it through the process by which people actually get their messages. And we're having, I don't know, we'll see how we come out, but it's fascinating to me that the other side has been dying to get us into court. You know, sue us, sue us, sue us. Then we can hand it to a bunch of lawyers, and then it's off our table, and then we can screw you up, and we'll hire Jerry Fasher or somebody like that who can make magic for us. So yes, I think that one of the lessons that Jan learned is that when you go to court, you put your case in somebody else's control to a very large extent. You buy into a process which is not of your making. You buy into a bunch of people running the process who are not of your choosing. And you lose an immense amount of control over your own story. And so to try and tell the story free of those constraints with that in the background as a possible horrible alternative for people is a very effective approach, I think.
You also
Hey, wait, on the microphone here, Jerry. We've got to get quick. Yeah, no, we want you to record it, though. That's the idea. This is for posterity.
Precisely what system he was entering, and the war was declared first by the plaintiffs, as you well know. So that if you want a system like the Industrial Accident Board, where you can go eliminate all these other things that the plaintiffs rely on, that's fine. That you wouldn't be in favor of that, neither would I. Mediation, we all are in favor of. It wasn't invented as a result of this case. Harvard Law School has been talking about alternative dispute resolution for probably 30 years. But it's just a way of resolving a dispute in a different way, and probably a more civilized way. But ultimately, some cases do come to court because people are stubborn and they don't want to settle, or they can't settle, or they don't like each other, or they're not reasonable. And then eventually the court has to decide that. But if you're looking for very large sums of money, these days and always, juries were the only place you could get large sums.
Well, I agree with you to a large extent, Jerry, but I think the thing that's new in the picture is the recognition of the power of storytelling. The old ADR kind of approach kind of assumes a static environment and there are a bunch of interests and you get people together and you mediate them, but you're not really changing the environment. You're just mediating it. The newer approach is to recognize that what you're really doing in litigation is articulating a story and building an audience for it and a consensus around it. And the instruments for doing it are not limited to filing a lawsuit and then speaking on the courthouse steps. And in fact, you give up many of the instruments of storytelling when you go into court. It's got its pluses, but it's got its sacrifices. So I think it's still possible to go for very big goals and stay out of court to do it if the story gets big enough. I mean, you fight for story all the time, and you fight outside of court as well as inside of court. Right.
Listen, I think there's some interesting conversions possible in your current work on the internet and the problem with expert witnesses in the case. According to a recent book called Data Smog, there's a real crisis in the information society because there's a sort of complete lack of authority on the net. A source like the New York Times is accessible and often is reported as the drug report or something like that. And I thought, in the same case with expert witnesses, really, how on earth is the jury supposed to adjudicate between dueling hydrogeologists? And my sense when I read that was to think that really, first of all, a lot of other countries perhaps have better systems in terms of maybe having court-appointed experts. But also, I was wondering if you endorsed any reforms like Carl Llewellyn endorsed merchant juries for contract cases. I mean, sort of experts on the experts. People who would be able to say, you know, this is a respective hydrogeologist, they should sort of hear from each side's hydrogeologist, but ultimately they will sort of produce a report and get submitted to the jury.
No, I don't endorse any approach like that. I think that the American jury is at the heart of the American legal system, which is at the heart of the American system. And the essence of it is that ordinary people who are a cross-section of all of us ultimately make a judgment on the most important issues of fact that are involved in the law. I do think the internet offers wonderful opportunities, though, and I like Data Smog as a kind of a starting point just in terms of looking at it. One of the things that we're into here is developing something that we're calling jury trial in cyberspace, not as in like an official jury trial, but as a way of focusing issues and dealing with conflict and building consensus around them. And it's a pretty simple idea that the internet is an ideal place for forming up discussion groups. And if you have a well-presented issue that's got two sides to it and you've got web development under each issue that jurors or discussants can probe and dig into, and an environment in which they can speak and consult with various persons and then be polled, that you've got a way of drawing people into these issues. And so specifically for a civil action, the two issues that I'm most interested in, I'm an evidence teacher. The science in the courtroom issue is, to me, the deepest of the issues. I came out of the Woburn case, and after a period, got into the Daubert case. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but this is the case in the junk science case in the Supreme Court, where I was in the Supreme Court on the brief on the respondent's side, representing the company, not the plaintiffs. And the Daubert case resulted in a whole shakeup of the way judges look at science in the courtroom. And we've been engaged since then in doing judicial conferences on the science issue in all of the different states. We just did the Conference of Chief Judges just a couple of weeks ago. And the two issues out of Woburn that are like the quintessential science in the courtroom issues are the hydrology question, where you've got a lot of esoteric expertise, but nobody thinks that the underlying logic is beyond comprehension. That is, how things move underground may be complicated, but it's knowable. And the leukemia issue, that is, did the stuff once in the wells, in the water, actually cause the leukemia? That's a different kind of science issue. That's one where no matter how much facts you gather about it, we still don't understand the etiology of the disease. The only way you get to a conclusion is with a statistical form of analysis. As nobody knows what causes leukemia. What you can do is you can map out correlations and come to a conclusion that TCE in the water caused the leukemia. But nobody can tell you exactly in molecular terms how it happened. And so there are these two sort of quintessential science in the courtroom issues. And our ambition is actually to, in effect, start a judicial college of the internet built around deep exploration of these two issues as part of this Lessons from Woburn project. So yes, I think the internet is a fabulous tool. Its biggest problem is, just as you say, people don't know where quality is in it. I'd go further. So far, the internet has been seen first as a kind of an information space where you look things up, and then it's going through a phase now of being conceived as a commercial space where you go to buy things. It's just beginning to be seen as a teaching space. It's an incredibly powerful new medium that's opening for teachers as a narrative space, and that's what that's really what we're exploring with the Lessons from Woburn project in relationship to internet. Yeah.
I can understand how the internet is a wonderful device for getting out a story. And having heard delivery from a client in the last session, that enabled the client's prime objective was to get out the story, so that this horrible kind of issue doesn't happen again. And the story has gotten out through the movies and the internet exists at this context, and the time lost its file. Might have been another way to get out a story. I don't know if this is the case of the Harvard professor that you just referred to, but if I'm a Harvard professor and I wasn't promoted or granted tenure, I'm an assistant professor, what I want to happen is to show that the tenure process was unjust, that indeed I should have been promoted or granted tenure. How does the internet, now that story, if I'm common, that story is kind of personal. I don't know that I want to get it out that much. I do want to get promoted because I like Cambridge and I want to stay here. So maybe you could, how does the internet resolve that kind of issue? I certainly understand how it's getting up to the point of quality, but I wonder about something like that.
The first case we did on the internet, I should have it here. I wear a civil action jacket around, and perhaps people see me wearing it. That was my fee in a case, right? The first case we did on the internet, I did it out of my evidence class last year, came when the producer, Scott Rudin, he's not Rachel Pfeffer, but he was one of the producers of A Civil Action, called up and said one of his assistant producers, Noah Ackerman, had a problem. So he puts me on with Noah. Noah says, I've got a brother, Kevin, who's a junior at Boston University, who got arrested for arson. And he's being prosecuted for arson. And his lawyer has not succeeded in getting anything done, a guy named Altman that I knew who, he just has not been able to move the case at all. Is there anything you can do to help? So we took it as the first case that we would do on the internet. And I assigned a group of my evidence students to it, and they went out and they investigated the witnesses, and they put up a website, which you can go look at, and they went and talked to the prosecutor, and the next thing you knew, the Boston Globe was, this is interesting, internet, and so forth, and the next thing you knew, prosecutor drops the case. And I got the jacket as a fee. All right, so what's the model? The model is, yes, we could take Peter Berkowitz's case. Nobody's ever heard of Peter Berkowitz in the real world. Nobody really has got a big investment in him. And we could go down and file a lawsuit, which we're going to get killed on. Some judge is going to come in and tell Harvard that their process is no good, out of the blue, with no deep underpinning in public credibility. It's not the way power works. On the other hand, if we start to tell Peter's story in a way that is, you know, it expands, it gets bigger, he gets an audience, people begin to see that Harvard, if it aspires to a leadership role in the internet, where the model of governance is open and transparent, is being run from the top by a system that has one person able to make the most important decisions on no reviewable record whatsoever and no accountability whatsoever, it begins to build up an audience. And when you get a good enough audience, then we could go to court. Yeah, we could go and sue Harvard on just a simple contract that a young man who comes here has got a right to a fair process. It's a specific performance of the right to, you know, have a fair shot at a professorship at Harvard, irreplaceable. And at that point, it begins to have enough muscle, so I think we'd get past the motion to dismiss and maybe into a discovery process, and suddenly we're into an area where all the secrecy that they use to surround it starts to come loose, where we can start talking about things that Jerry Fasher likes to talk about. So yeah, I think the internet's the relationship between media and law is intricate, and what Schlickman did, he did it at that time within the court system, was he ran a media case as well as he ran a law case. And it became a bigger and bigger, it's still a media case. We went out through book media and now film media. He wins it in the media, even as Jerry Fasher also in some way wins it in the media. But there's win in it. It's not just a zero-sum game at that point. And internet, I think, is just a huge new instrument of media that people are just beginning to figure out how to use. Please.
In your internet example, you want to remind you of that Charles Garrett quote, Charles Garrett quote, a lawyer, a civil rights and criminal lawyer from San Francisco, was brought to Newton, a black man from Newton, charged with murder. And Newton had to be as good as Perry Mason. He said, better because Perry Mason's minds are all innocent.
Ackerman, yeah. I have to say, one of the benefits of being a professor rather than a practicing lawyer is I don't have to take every case that comes in the door. I get to first talk to Kevin Ackerman and make my own credibility assessment. I get to talk to Peter Berkowitz and make my own assessment as whether I want to commit. And yeah, once you commit, you're in. But if the first instinct is right, you're in pretty good shape. Okay. Yeah.
In regards to the internet, it seems like the internet is becoming more commercial and non-commercial, and you can squeeze further and further back. Two questions. One is how do you feel that you can expand
tied into that commercialism and allow your vision to expand?
Yes, I think that's that really asks what the core strategy is of the Berkman Center. And I can just give it to you in 2 minutes. The Berkman Center is committed to openness as a philosophy, expressed through open code as opposed to proprietary code, open content as opposed to proprietary content, open commerce, and open politics. All right, now the open code part is where you get a first big competition. At this point, it's pretty much with Microsoft. And we think that there's a role to be played in providing kind of a cooperative form of leadership to the whole open code movement. And that's underway and is just immensely exciting. The open content, once you go beyond the code to content, that's where we're at with this project. At the Internet and Society conference that we did here last May, Larry Ellison, who runs Oracle and is really into the idea of education as a commercial venture, spoke, and his message was the number one product on the Internet is going to be education. And if only I had the Harvard brand, what money I could make. All right, now, Harvard's approach to it is not to treat education as a product to be sold as such. It's really the other way around. Harvard's business plan has always basically been the endowment model. That is, you put out good stuff, and later on, you get back from people who are grateful. And so that leads into a strategy of free and open content, which is what we're trying to do with the Lessons from Woburn project. That is, create educational resources which are open and usable by all sorts of different people, and open also in the sense of the architecture of construction. That is, we're anxious to connect with groups that are willing to make pieces that fit. And so that ultimately what you're shooting for is something that will make the open part of it quite robust. Now, that's not to say that there's no fit with commercial. So, for instance, Marilyn's film is going to be available on the Internet. But if you want to actually have a cassette of it, the cassette will be for sale, and there will be some profit markup on it for her that will fund her operation. So, and that is basically the way we're looking at all of it. That is, the information is free, but the different forms that may be convenient or not, all right, people will be asked to pay for those. Yeah. No, it's not the cost of participating. Absolutely not. But and when you
not the cost of participating, but to do something to encourage them more than you might have.
Let me put it on this way. I think that there are opportunities to create there's opportunity to create enormous value. Then the commercial question is, how do you capture the value? The traditional commercial way of capturing value is to charge for it up front. There is another model. There's a gift economy model, which more and more people are coming to believe in because the costs of producing the value relative to the value created are so small. We in this group, I think, can create enormous value at relatively little cost. Then it's just a matter of people who benefit from it being willing to give back enough to make it profitable, not on condition, but on gift. And so far, that's been a model that's been working. It's a good model. It's a comfortable model. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm a truck engineer, and I thought this woman case would be a landmark case. The first I heard of it, it was in the early 80s. And I saw it as a kind of ideological concept. And I have heard a number of things this morning, and I think I heard you say something like 10 years ago. It confirmed my suspicion that there was an attempt to send a message or to change the rules of industry, whatever. And I wondered if there is an element of that, and whether Grace saw it as that. And one of the reasons I thought this way is because Peter Grace was at the time a very prominent conservative, a Reaganite, who would have made a very delicious target for somebody from the left. I wonder if there was a substantial left right, and she certainly looks to me like a leftist. Was there an element of not so much focus on the case and sending a message, regardless of who wins, but getting the message out? And there's been a lot of talk about the media and so on. So was it the media the message rather than the case?
Well, there was certainly a huge environmental component to it.
It was not a good case. It seemed to me, not as a lawyer, but I thought, boy, if you wanted to fix somebody to really nail, you could have found somebody who was a lot more vulnerable to it. It could be a lot easier to prove a case on it. This, I thought, was difficult to prove. Sort of like in the civil rights cases, you mentioned civil rights, where there was a kind of mission to choose not the bad races, but the moderates. And I'm sure you've heard this said many times. There's a strategy that if you could really persecute or crucify the slightly racist people, the message would be sent to the real racists. So they'd better watch out. And I wondered if race was that kind of a target, where there was an intent to send a message to all industries that you'd better be careful.
I can't say that it just didn't feel right to even think about it that way. That wasn't the way people went into it. It may have become that in some minds, but it's not like you choose your cases in that sense. It wasn't like we said, okay, we'll take that one and not that one. You commit to it. What would you say, Bill?
Later on, when it became, that's when we talked about sending a message. But sending a message part, I think, was certainly a secondary consideration for us. And I talked just last hour about, the primary responsibility of the family's lawyers is really for the family. And we try to always keep your eye on that point and do your best within their best.
Here, let me get Harry here. I don't know, Harry. I don't know. Here's what I've learned so far. You just start, and then you see what the next problem is, and you make your need clear as you go along. It's not like a strategy where you keep everything secret, and then you come out with something. It's rather you've got a problem, and you state what your problem is, and you talk it over with people who are interested in talking it over with you, and then you go for it. And then you report on it. And that builds up a bunch of other people that are kind of interested. And then you see what the next problem is. And so it's not this thing where you make an art object and then reveal it. It's much more dynamic. I'd say the essence of what we're doing, I think of it as like practicing law backwards, where you're public. And it's not attorney-client privilege and secret. It's like everybody is part of the legal discussion. In Peter's case, we actually worked on a document and worked on it on the net, and before we filed the document, the other side responded and gave us their answer. They were following us on the net, and they just jumped ahead and said, no, that's not right, no, and all that. But I'm fascinated with the idea of doing things kind of back the other way. I'm actually very interested in this point to see if you could write a movie backwards, whether you could the script of this movie. I feel like it was a B+. I feel like it's pretty good, but the story doesn't look coherent to me as I look at it there. There are deep questions in the case that are just made out as if they're trivial. The question that brought me into the case was the profound issues around the scientific evidence. To watch the movie, there's no science question of any serious quality in there. It's easy. It's not easy. So the idea that Jonathan said it in an early session, if you were to do a screenplay out in the open, they're worried it would never get done. On the other hand, I'm kind of interested in the idea of what would happen if you actually did a screenplay, you built a screenplay so that the people who were interested actually had a role in it and then saw it reified, rather than they get presented like a work of art and then have to go back and make their connections themselves. And that's the same idea with internet. It's just a process of turning around the other way and being really open about the problems and having faith that if you inquire openly, that you'll build audience and eventually you'll build an answer. Okay.
My question to you is whether you think the rules of ethics and the disciplinary codes that otherwise govern lawyers do apply to the concept of litigating on the internet, and if not, why they shouldn't.
In many ways, I regard the conflict of interest that you're observing as a plus rather than a minus, because it's to be explained. It's part of it. I actually care about this case because I care about Harvard. It's like I don't regard Peter and me as litigating against Harvard. I regard Peter and me as being Harvard. We are Harvard. And we're as much Harvard as President Rubenstein is Harvard. And so they've got a conflict on their side, too. So from my point of view, well, I'm not. I'm acting as his legal advisor. And I'm not claiming. He's got an actual lawyer. When we get to court, Matt Feinberg is going to be the guy who's the attorney of record. He already is. I'm his legal advisor. I think in any sort of media litigation, you're in a rhetorical space. It's rhetorical that you're. It's essentially PR. All right. So now the classic foundations of rhetoric are the clarity of the message, the spirit of the message, and the charisma of the speaker, the character of the speaker. Right? So what we're talking about is a question of character when it comes to conflict of interest. And the lawyers have conflict of interest rules so that they're insulated from character questions. But if you're actually going for, I think, persuasion in a broader environment, you welcome the character questions. Ultimately, character is what persuades. That's what I think. So I regard the conflict issue in fact, as a plus, not a minus.
Two questions. In the two sessions I've attended this morning, I've heard one speaker say that Judge Skinner's questions were fair and good. Another speaker say they were not fair and bad.
My only question is, who said they were good? Who? that's a joke.
In using your movie analogy with the community setting the form of the movie, Disney wouldn't buy that because they want control. It's their money. So how would you carry it forward in using the movie analogy to litigation that you would get everybody involved in the development of the movie to put a little money in so that you could end up matching the need of the money?
Well, we're really getting into some speculative territory here, but I'll share with you a plan which I haven't shared with the participants yet, so we're really ahead of ourselves. Here's my dream at the moment. Steve Zaylian just gets finished doing a civil action. His next project is The Dukes of Deception. Now, I don't know whether you're familiar with The Dukes of Deception. I recommend it to you highly as a book. It's just a totally wonderful book. It's a book about fathers. It's a book about a guy who is writing about his father, and his father turns out to have been a charlatan. But at the same time, he turns out to be the most wonderfully lovable man to this kid. And so it's actually the dilemma of how a kid comes to terms with the fact that his hero has got a big fake element to it. And this, so it's a wonderful, wonderful story. It happens that it very closely overlaps my own story. I think it probably overlaps. I think it's got a lot of universal qualities in it for a lot of people. And so I'm actually interested in the possibility of seeing if I could tempt Zaylian into the idea of doing a kind of open project, and even tempt Disney into the idea that the internet's a new space, that it's very important for them to start to understand it, and that maybe this would be a very interesting kind of venture for them. I don't know. We'll see. That's the thought. I hereby wrap up and send you all to lunch.